I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, Mexican food and how it's interpreted here in the U.S. A twist on the beloved matzo ball, a look at kosher food in France, plus pica, the desire to eat dirt. And Jonathan Gold takes us out for food from Singapore. But first, let's head out to the Santa Monica Farmers Market for a look at what's in season in Southern California this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Michael Cimarusti is one of the best known and best chefs in Los Angeles. In fact, he's just received his third James Beard Award nomination. This one is for Best Chef in the Pacific. And Michael, you're here today shopping as always. We see you here practically every week at the market. Of course, you're known for the seafood at Providence. Let's talk about seasonal vegetables and tell us what you're shopping for today.
So now, we're talking today, it's smack dab in the middle of spring, and one of the things that I look forward to, and of course I think our guests at Providence look forward to every year, is Zuckerman's asparagus from the Delta. It's a world-class ingredient. I mean, it compares to, any of the finest products you'd find throughout the world, and we use it in several different dishes at the restaurant right now, because it's one of those things that there is no better asparagus really in the world. So.
And when you say the Delta, is that the soil, the region, what makes it so special? And
yeah.
Where it comes from, Stockton, right?
Yeah, Zuckerman's Delta asparagus is what we're talking about. So, yeah, I think it's a combination of the soil. I think it's a combination of the history. They've been doing it for years and years and years, so clearly they know what they're doing. Any other asparagus just pales in comparison. We always buy the jumbos, which are the biggest ones, so they're about as big around as your thumb. Mm. They have just, a wonderful texture. When they're cooked, you could shave them raw. They're so big, you can shave them raw very thinly and just splash them with a little really good olive oil, maybe a squeeze of lemon juice and some sea salt, and they'd be wonderful like that as a cold salad. I love to grill them. I think, if you blanch them first, peel them, of course, because they're really wide, so you need to peel them because they get quite fibrous. But so once they're peeled, you would just blanch them in well-salted water until they're tender, and then you could either finish them off by grilling them. One of my favorite things to do right now is roast them in brown butter. So you put them in a pan. Once they're cooked, you drain them very well, dab them off maybe a bit with paper towels, put them in a pan with a little bit of brown butter, some salt again, and then we finish them all sorts of ways. One thing that we have at the restaurant, which is really great, is a smoked sesame seeds that we get from a source in Japan, which are just incredibly flavorful. You could put them on anything and they taste good, mm-hmm. but on Zuckerman's asparagus, they taste especially good. Another great thing to do with them is just sprinkle them just after you've browned them in whole butter or brown butter, is take them out of the pan, put them on a plate or on a tray, something that's oven-proof, sprinkle them with some very finely grated Parmigiano Reggiano, and then just stick them under the broiler and let that Parmesan create a bit of a crust on the outside of the asparagus. That is incredibly delicious, too. And really, I think a lot of people, they think of asparagus as, sort of a side dish. But asparagus like this, Zuckerman's asparagus, I think it deserves, center of the plate attention. Make that the sort of centerpiece of the meal, because it's that good, and it deserves that sort of attention, I think. We import white asparagus from Holland, because no one really grows its equivalent here in the United States. So we import white asparagus from Holland, and the seasons run pretty much concurrently. And I can tell you that, this product that's shipped from overseas, I'd say that the flavor, the texture, and the overall quality of the product, it stands up to that Dutch white asparagus, in every way, I think, the Zuckerman Delta asparagus.
For a fraction of the cost, no doubt.
For a fraction of the cost, that's right, yeah.
That was Michael Cimarusti. He's the owner, executive chef of Providence, a very well-known restaurant, consistently fantastic. And he's here singing the praises of that wonderful Zuckerman asparagus. People don't normally think about nuts as being seasonal, and that nuts do have a green season and then a mature season. We have something new here, which is green almonds. And we're talking with Nate Siemens, who's one of the owners of Fat Uncle Farm. They come to our Wednesday and our Sunday markets here in Santa Monica. And, Nate, your table is just festooned with little fuzzy. They look like little immature peaches is what they look like.
Yeah.
This is the green almond. Now, I bit into one. I was told it's tart, which it is. And when you look at the middle of a green almond, it's like where the nut would be. It's just a little blob of clear jelly, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us what's going on here and how these are going to turn into almonds.
Well, right now they're only a few weeks old. At the end of February, they were They were pollinated, and they grow really quick. Just in about a month and a half, they've already gotten to this size right here from basically nothing.
And they're pollinated by those poor put-upon bees?
Yes, all the bees come from all over the western U.S. to help us out with our almonds. Right. They're very nice of them to do that. They're really cute right now. As you notice, they've got this nice fuzzy texture to them, and they'll stay like that for another few months. But right now, just at the end of April, the beginning of May, is the short green almond season when the almonds can be eaten whole. The whole thing, the fruit on the outside, and what will turn into the woody shell later, and the middle, which will harden up into an almond. As you notice, they're still gelatinous all the way through.
Yeah.
In the part that will be the almond, that will develop into the almond, is gelatinous right now. And that is an even shorter season. That's only about two and a half week season on those gelatinous ones. Once it solidifies that, I'll crack this one open for you right now.
The inside
is still gelatinous right now, and that'll harden up. Those proteins will solidify, and there's a season for those as well. It's about a 3 week season for that. So two back to back seasons: one where they're soft and supple, and the second season where they're just white.
Now, one of our chefs last week brought a jar of pickled green almonds. Right now, they're pickling them with the little fuzzy green, the whole thing.
They'll pickle this for about the next 4 weeks. The part that limits the pickling is once the shell, what will develop into the shell, starts to become woody.
Right.
Because that you can't pickle out of the almond. That's mm-hmm. just, once it's solid, it's solid. It's a done deal.
And you're just harvesting by hand?
That's correct. These have to be harvested by hand. The rest of the almond crop are harvested mechanically with shakers. But these, we come through and we just pick them right off the tree.
Try to describe the flavor of these. If you're just going to, and your method is, do you eat the whole thing? Do you eat it a half at a time?
Yeah.
What do you think it tastes like?
Yeah, growing up, I didn't realize that these were a delicacy. I just thought that they were just, you know, something handy to munch on. But we'd crack them open and just eat the middle. But you can eat the outside as well. It's very tart. So if most people, you know, they come by and they ask how to serve these, I say just slice it up, you know, thin slices, and toss it over salad. Because it complements most of the...
With the husk on it? Husk and everything.
Yeah,
okay.
That fruit is it's got a real nice kind of palate-cleansing tartness to it right now.
All right, Nate, so you're at the Wednesday Santa Monica, the Sunday Main Street Santa Monica. What other markets can we find you at here in L.A.?
We're at a few other ones in West L.A. Alexa sells for us at Mar Vista, which is a wonderful little market on Sundays. And Studio City is another one we sell it to. Yeah.
Okay, well, good. Well, they're delicious, and thanks for bringing us this very rare seasonal treat. We appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure.
That was Nate Siemens, and he's an owner-farmer up at Fat Uncle Farm, and they're bringing in very short-season, fuzzy little green almonds. Try one just to say you did. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Asparagus recipes from Michael Cimaresti are on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. And you know, it's really funny, but I actually have a picture of green almonds on my screensaver. I think they're so beautiful. To eat them, I just like to rub off the little bit of peach fuzz that's on the outside and then dip them in salt or in salt and olive oil. They're addictive. Passover begins on Tuesday, the holiday when Jews commemorate the Exodus from Egypt. I'll be back after this short break with matzo balls, kosher wine, and more for your Passover Seder. You're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food, and I'm here in the studio this morning with Ilan Hall, chef owner of the Gorbals in downtown L.A. I should mention that we have a little visitor in the form of four-month-old Theo, too, so you might hear him in the background smacking his lips. Ilan was born to embrace a world of culinary tastes, and at his restaurant, the Gorbals, you can see his affection for juxtaposing traditions that some might think belong in separate neighborhoods, let alone the same plate. He was famously the winner of the second season of Top Chef. Jews all over the world are getting ready right now for the Passover holidays, so I thought, what better person to talk to than Ilan about the matzo ball.
Hello.
Hi, I'm so happy you came and brought your little son.
I'm happy to be here. So is Theo. First radio studio.
Describe the elements that make up a matzo ball and what exactly is a matzo ball.
If you don't know what a matzo ball is, you probably don't know what matzah is. So it goes back to Egypt when the Jews were escaping. They didn't have time for their bread to rise, for the yeast to set in, so they just cooked them without letting them rise. Unleavened bread, matzah. So it's really just a cracker, essentially. It's just bread without any yeast in it. A matzo ball is then made from matzo meal, which is ground up matzah. So ground up matzo meal or cracker meal you can also use. I know lots of people that use cracker meal. Not as kosher, but still just as good. And then you mix it with eggs, some sort of a leavening agent. The way I do is with a leavening agent. You're not really supposed to. And then you boil them. Some, you know, it can have vegetable oil in it. It could have chicken fat, schmaltz, which is really, really traditional.
And they're dumplings, basically.
And they're dumplings. They're cracker meal dumplings for the layman.
And what was your childhood relationship to matzo balls?
Well, the matzo balls that I knew in my life were really heavy, dense matzo balls that my grandmother, Erna Frischer, who's still alive, she used to make them and would make them with love and, you know, the broth would be really good, but there were these heavy, 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 dense balls that would just sort of
sinkers, we call
those. Sinkers, yes. They dropped to the bottom of the bowl, and they dropped to the bottom of my stomach.
Usually that's a conversation amongst matzo ball aficionados is sinkers or floaters? What's your preference?
Floaters, definitely.
Yeah, for me too. Although, you know, a lot of the ones that we really love that we go to delis to eat, they're all sinkers.
That's not totally true. I think Cantor's has a great matzo ball. It's only one in the bowl. It's one giant matzo ball. But it's a sinker just for its sheer mass, but it's not. It's actually relatively light.
That's true.
Pretty fluffy.
It is fluffy. Let's not talk yet about your restaurant matzo ball because that is extremely particular.
Okay.
But when you're making them in a more traditional way, what fat do you use?
If I'm making them for a family function, I'll use chicken fat. Chicken fat, I think, is the tastiest and gives it a really, really beautiful, nice sort of fluffy texture. It's akin to another type of fat that we're not supposed to talk about.
Yeah, but we'll get to that other fat later. And do you render your own?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll get it from kosher butchers. I'll ask them to save it. And they'll a lot of kosher butchers actually want to make the schmaltz for me. But schmaltz, for people that don't know, is chicken fat that's been rendered and then cooled, and it's used as butter in place so that when you're eating a kosher meal, you can have a fat to spread on all of your carbs and lovely stuff.
Yeah, it's pumpernickel bread with a nice schmear of schmaltz. Mm. Pretty good.
Yeah.
So take me through the process. What do you do?
Very simple. Just eggs, matzo meal. I use sparkling water, because it's not officially a leavening agent, but it gives it a lightness. A little bit of rendered chicken fat, and then I'll just blend it all together, very, mix it by hand, because if you do it with a machine, you can tend to overmix it. And when you overmix it, you'll kill the bubbles, you'll overwork the cracker, so you don't, and the cracker meal, so you don't want to, the matzo meal. So you don't want to, you don't want to do that. You want to be pretty gentle with it. And then I let it cool down in the fridge for half an hour, just till it's nice and firm. Because when you first mix it, the amounts that we do, it's a little bit soupy and soft. But when you let it sit, the chicken fat hardens it all right up. And then it's ready to roll.
Now, do you cook them in broth or do you cook them in water and then reheat them in broth?
It depends. I'll cook them in broth, but I'll have separate broth from the broth that I'm actually using. Because when we pour broth, I want it to be like nice and clear and really, really clean looking. When you've cooked matzo balls in it, it sort of leaves it. I still drink that broth later, but I don't tell people about that. And so I'll cook it in broth, in seasoned broth, you know, just as if it were going into the soup, and then I'll pull it aside, let it sort of rest for a little bit, and then re-enter it with the soup.
So now let's talk about how you sort of veer off course from this traditional mode in your restaurant, the Gorbals. Explain sort of what your culinary ethos is so people have a frame in which to place these interesting matzo balls.
My culinary ethos, it's to not take food too seriously, but try and, you know, what we try and do at the restaurant is we try and pair things that we find delicious, no matter what culture, no matter what, where it's from. Not that we try to fuse. Oh, is that right, Theo? Not that we try and fuse too much together, but I'll just take elements of different cuisines that I love and really sort of see how they go together. So, for instance,
one day you were playing around with a matzo ball and you decided.
I decided to wrap it in bacon. It was meant as a joke for a fellow Jew's birthday party. I grew up Jewish, but not kosher at all. And
not observant.
Not observant. And so one of the dishes I put on the menu, thinking it would be funny, were bacon-wrapped matzo balls. So I actually made them, and when I made them for the party, it was the first time I'd ever made them. I was just sort of I got a really good matzo ball recipe that I modified a little bit, tweaked. I actually tried adding yeast to it, which is so ironic.
A donut matzo ball.
Yeah. And then I made them, and actually the oven was broken. I was going to cook them at a much higher heat, but the oven was broken. It was at really low, so what happened, all the fat from the bacon slowly sort of got absorbed into the matzo ball, and it toward the end of it, it was about 45 minutes in there, it formed this super crispy coating on the bacon, and then the matzo ball inside was super fluffy and just light and airy, and it was marvelous.
A revelation.
It was a revelation. It was so delicious.
How was it served?
We did it a few different ways, but we just do it on top of a horseradish aioli, so fresh horseradish, because when my father would make broth, because he wouldn't make the matzo ball soup, but he would make just regular broth and serve it also, it would have horseradish in it. So the flavor of horseradish is really synonymous with matzo balls to me. So
now, do you ever add this is for the restaurant, not for a traditional Passover meal, but do you ever add baking powder, baking soda to your mixture?
We do. We have baking powder in the mix, and it just – after trying different leavening agents, because trying to make it as fluffy as possible, we use sparkling water, we use baking powder, and then pork fat, and that combination somehow just does it right.
It has been such a pleasure talking to you, and I love that you brought your little Theo with you.
I wish he could talk. He could say something interesting.
Soon. The next time, maybe.
Maybe.
Thank you, Ilan.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking with Ilan Hall, the chef and owner of The Gorbals in downtown L.A. He joined me in the studio with his four-month-old son, Theo. A few people on Facebook have asked me about making vegan matzo balls. Not an easy thing to do it without the egg, but we have a recipe for you on the Good Food blog. French cooking and the whole French way of eating is a huge and endlessly fascinating subject. Throw in the wild card of Jewish cooking in France, and you have threads of immigration, history, trends, and tradition all mixed up. Jewish culinary authority Joan Nathan joins us this morning. Her new book is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. The French-Jewish connection seems like it would be a bit complex to investigate. Could you talk for a minute about, I don't know if we call it complex political relationship or a complex cultural relationship between France and the Jews?
Well, the Jews have lived in France for 2,000 years. They came with the expulsion of the Jews from Palestine, Palestine being named by the Romans as for ancient Israel. And they came to Rome. They came to Catalonia, Spain, and also Catalonia, France. It was, you know, France wasn't France in those days. And throughout history, Jews have been welcomed and they've been expelled from France. There have been, throughout history, all kinds of awful times in France for the Jews, but also wonderful times. And it is complex, especially because of the Dreyfus Affair at the end of the 19th century. And then again, World War II, where 83,000 Jews were sent away. The French say ils ont disparu, they disappeared. but they disappeared in Auschwitz. And of the 83,000 that were sent away, 6,000 returned. So it is complex. And yet the Jews stayed in France after the Second World War. Today, it's the third largest Jewish community in the world after Israel and the United States.
Do French Jews still keep their Jewishness hidden?
Many do. A lot of Eastern European Jews came to France at the end of the 19th century, the way that they came to the United States. There were 2.5 million in the United States, and there were about 100,000 that came to France at the end in the 19th century. And they had names like Ginsburg and Nemirovsky, Irene Nemirovsky. And they were distinctively Jewish names. What's happened is a lot of Jews changed their names. So you have, well, you do have names like Yves Montand, who's Jewish, right? So is Sonia Riquiel. They don't sound Jewish. You know, the French in general are reticent or more reserved than we are. And Jews of France are more reserved as well.
Has kosher food then always been marginalized in France? Or is it a type of food that has always been there?
Well, yes, it has been there since the Jews have lived there for 2,000 years. You know, their recipes, I'll give you an example. Bouillabaisse clearly has shellfish in it. It's a fish stew. But bourride is a fish stew like bouillabaisse with only kosher fish, so that the Jews could eat bourride, whereas maybe they would not eat bouillabaisse. And people think that this bourride came with the Phoenicians. I think that it perhaps came with Jews that were with the Phoenicians.
You talk about these four towns that during the Middle Ages were the only four towns that Jews were allowed to live in. So you actually went to Cavaillon, one of these towns. Did you find a hotbed of recipe repository there?
Cavaillon has a beautiful synagogue. So I went to the synagogue, and it's right near the Carrière, which is really the ghetto where the Jews lived. And from the 14th century, when Jews were kicked out of the rest of France, they were allowed to live in these four towns, Cavaillon, Carpentras, Avignon, and Ile-sur-la-Sorgue. They were under the protectorate of the Pope. And Jews lived in this carrière. They were locked in the evening, and they were let out at 8 o'clock in the morning. And there were no stores there. They walked to the regular town for bread and for other things, for the public ovens where they put all their hot foods. Of course, there were little fires in their apartments, but it was dangerous, you know, to have a big fireplace there, because if something happened in the middle of the night, nobody was going to let them out. So the Jews, we walk into town, and I learned a lot just by thinking about how food moved. By the way, there was a matzah bakery in the synagogue, and from the research that I did, I discovered that the Gentile community loved matzah. And so in the, like, 13th, 14th century, the matzahs were baked in the synagogue bakery, and they would buy many, many for the Christian bakeries around the town, and they were distributed. And to this day in France, pain azim is what they call pain azim, is a diet food for the French.
Recently, I read an interview that you did with Margie Rockland for Squid Ink of the LA Weekly, and you talked briefly about the tradition of kosher wine in France and how different it is from the tradition of kosher wine here. Could you describe how it's different?
Here's an example. I went to the an academic book that was written by a professor at Wellesley. And she talked about the definition of the great rabbi of France, that his job description was to look over kosher wine. So I, through my family, was able to meet the Grand Rabbin of Bordeaux. And he took me out into the fields. And what they do in France, it's totally different from the United States. Kosher wine is made kosher by the run of wines. There are no kosher wineries in France. Well, actually, there's one. It's a very tiny winery just for sort of ritualistic purposes, but not good wine, you know? So that what happens is a négociant goes to the winery, and he speaks to the head of the winery, who most of the time doesn't know a thing about kosher wine. And he says, look, I will buy up 3,000 bottles of your wine if you will do the following. One of them is to make, of course, kosher wine, which means that after the grapes are picked, that it's a Sabbath observant Jew that will take care of making the wine. And of course, whatever's put in the wine has to be kosher. So unfortunately, or fortunately, the wine season is right in the middle, not only of the Sabbath when they could not stir the wine, but also right in the middle of two fall Jewish holidays, Sukkot and Simchas Torah, which are not just a one-day holiday. They're several days each, and they come right near each other. So what the winemakers have to do, and by the way, they have to guarantee the same quality of wine that they give for everybody else. So the vintner goes crazy because here they've started to ferment the wine. It's going wild. They want to stir it. They can't do anything with it. They can't touch it. So what they do is to slow it down. They put these, they look like they're ice cubes, but they're metal to keep it cold during the period so that they won't over ferment.
And so people who want to use kosher wine can have the best wines imaginable. It isn't a second-class citizen.
Absolutely.
I've heard you say that the French never take seconds at the table.
Right.
Is this true with French Jews?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what's the other thing is that there's such an élan. There's such a je ne sais quoi. You know, they really know how to eat at the table, to set the table, to present the food. And in every home I went to, you had a nice portion, but not a huge portion the way we would do. Even the matzo balls were tiny, not big matzo balls. You look at the matzo balls that we have in delis in America. The matzo balls there were a third of the size. And the same with dishes. And even though you're offered a second helping, rarely have I ever seen a French person taking a second helping. And they never eat in between meals. And, you know, they eat matzo sometimes. But they never discuss dieting at meals. No one ever does that.
Thank you so much, Joan.
Well, thank you, Evan.
I've been talking with Joan Nathan. Her latest book is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. If you'd like to join me at a Passover dinner at Angeli on Thursday, the 21st, I believe we still have reservations available. Coming up, Jonathan Gold is here with a restaurant for us to try, plus an exploration of eating dirt, pica. In 1 minute, here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. When kids make mud pies and lick their fingers, it's a childish game. The desire to eat earth as an adult is an oddity, yes, but it does happen. It's called pica. Sarah Young's the author of Craving Earth, a deeply researched look at this urge to eat clay, starch, ice, and chalk. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
What is pica?
Pica is a purposive consumption, the intentional consumption of things that are not typically considered food. There are kind of three main types of pica. One is craving earth, or eating earth. It's geophagy. The second type is amylophagy, and that's craving raw starches. And a really common example of that is cornstarch. And a third type of pica is what's called pagophagy, or craving ice. Now, you might think, well, I ate the ice in the bottom of my Coke, you know, do I have pica? And no, that's not pica. We're talking here really large quantities of ice. Like, imagine a party bag full of ice, you know.
And what is the quantity as it pertains to starch or to earth?
Almost any amount with that. The typical quantities are 30, you know, like a little handful. Like, imagine the palm of your hand being covered with earth or starch. That's the amount. But some women eat up to, for cornstarch, even one or two boxes of cornstarch a day.
So who is affected by pica primarily?
Primarily, it's pregnant women. In fact, it's almost, in some places, in some countries, it's a sign of being pregnant, and it's desire for eating earth. In Tanzania, where I've been doing research since 2000, it's definitely known as a behavior that is for pregnant women only. I tried to interview men to ask them about, just to make sure, basically, that they weren't eating non-food substances, that they weren't engaging in pica, and some of them just refused to talk to me about this. Why are you asking me about women's matters? Do I look pregnant to you?
And so as the pregnancy comes to a close, the pica goes away?
Frequently, yeah. Frequently it does. In fact, I was interviewing a woman who I had interviewed 2 years before. I asked her what it was that she thought that caused her cravings. And her little baby was now 2 years old and sitting on the floor next to her. And she pointed at him and said, "He caused it. He caused it." As soon as he left me, my cravings went away.
Is it common in the United States?
Surprisingly so. So in the United States, there's more of a stigma attached to eating things that we don't consider food, like cornstarch, like earth. And so it's frequently underreported. So in a study done among WIC recipients, that's women, infants, and children, so they're a low-income population here in the United States, something like 68% of those women had engaged in eating earth, ice, or starch.
And when it comes to the eating of earth, is it any dirt at all, or are people who have pica, are they looking for a particular type of earth?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing. People who are craving earth have very, very specific tastes for earth, based on how it looks, but even more importantly on how it smells. So women especially talk about the smell of earth after it's wet, especially after rain. Their acuity for picking out what's suitable earth and what isn't is amazing. Two examples. One, I walked really far into the sort of jungle in Zanzibar where I was doing research at the time to get to exactly this one bank. I mean, all the earth looked the same to me where we were walking. There was this one particular bank, and that was what people really sought out. And the second is that your senses change when with pregnancy. Hormones do wonderful and various things to your ability to smell and to taste. And so I did an experiment of my own. I got pregnant to see if I would, in fact, develop pica, and I didn't.
You got pregnant so you could see if you got pica?
I'm joking. There were lots of reasons for having a little baby. And science wasn't the only one. In fact, it was a failed experiment because in the end, I didn't have this urge. I've tasted lots of these substances, but it wasn't, I didn't feel compelled to.
You've described how some of the people that you interviewed, actually their mouths would start to water as they described the earth to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pleasure that people get from eating these substances is something that I don't think can be overemphasized. When you think about eating dirt, as most of us call it, you know, eating dirt would be the thing that you wouldn't want to eat. I mean, it's a pejorative term. It's not something we desire. It's something we try to clean up. But women and men, the few men who I have talked to who do this, really enjoy this stuff. They take great pleasure in it.
Is it a clay? Does it have a certain mineral content to it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, there are four components of earth. One is the humus, the really moist black stuff. Another part is the sand, and that's what you find at the beach. And then there's clay, that's the other part, and even a smaller particle size. And it's the clay that people are really seeking out. So we've analyzed some of the soils that geophagists eat, and we found that they all have an important amount of clay in them. Clay is preferred.
And what does that mean for the chicken and the egg of sort of the medical implications of pica? Are people looking to protect themselves from something, or are they seeking to gain something they don't have?
One of the reasons why I have made pica the focus of my research for the last 7 years is because people don't know why they're doing it. It's usually easier to study humans than it is to study animals or plants because you can ask them questions and say, why is it that you're eating this? And the explanations that people give me are like, because it's so delicious, because it's good, because I can't stop myself, because of how it tastes. Or most frequently, the answer is, I just don't know. There have been some hypotheses. There are three main hypotheses about why people are doing this. And the first is hunger. And that's pretty easy to rule out. The second is what you were alluding to earlier when you were asking about a mineral composition of it. Are people using this stuff as a kind of multivitamin, as a supplement? Are they getting something that is missing from their diet from these substances? And the other explanation is that it's a protective behavior. Let me explain that one a little further. It seems kind of counterintuitive to think that dirt could be protecting. But if you think about, like, for example, a clay mask that you put on your face, it binds really well to the impurities on your face and removes them. And so when you swallow clay, it acts also as a kind of mud mask for your gut. It can bind with your intestinal wall. It can also bind with things that you eat that might be harmful or poisonous.
Can it cause medical problems?
In the same way that it's really good at binding with things like bacteria or viruses that are harmful, it seems, although the experiments, we haven't completed them, it seems that this stuff can also bind with micronutrients. So the iron that you would otherwise have absorbed from your diet is actually being absorbed by these pica substances, such that that could be causing the anemia that's frequently seen among people who are engaging in pica.
So when you see populations of people with large amounts of anemia, do researchers immediately look for pica? Is that a telltale sign?
Yes. There are lots of things that can cause anemia. And there's a kind of natural amount of anemia that's found during pregnancy. But definitely, especially if somebody is pregnant, practitioners think, could this be pica? That said, a lot of people are overlooking it. I hope that one of the things I hope that this research does is to sort of alert people to the really interesting health implications of pica, not just the negative ones, which are possibly causing anemia, but possibly the beneficial aspects of this that have definitely been overlooked.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Dr. Sarah Young about pica, the uncontrollable urge to eat dirt, starch, or ice. And when it comes to ice, people are very particular.
It's phenomenal. There's one particular brand of ice that people lose it over. They're so enamored of it. There are a couple of websites where this love of what some people call rabbit turd ice, it's an ice that is served at Sonic restaurants, and it's this machine. I'm not receiving any money from them for saying this. Scotsman ice machine, or Scotsman brand ice makers. People adore it, and that's the ice that's preferred more than any other kind.
What about Europe? We haven't talked about Europe at all.
Yeah, good. So in Europe, you can definitely buy pica substances in what are called like ethnic shops. And so, for example, I went into one in London where they were selling clay from Ghana that was rolled into little tablets. And so it's available there. White Europeans, not so much. I haven't seen, I think, almost any population level studies of prevalence among white Europeans. But there are lots of reports of immigrants who've come up from Africa and the Middle East who are eating non-food things.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's been fascinating to write, and I've really appreciated all the people who have told me their pica stories.
Dr. Sarah Young is a faculty member in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell University and a Reproductive Infectious Disease Fellow at UC San Francisco. Her book is Craving Earth. Sarah sent me some earth samples. Check out the video of me tasting earth samples from Tanzania, Haiti, and the U.S. It's on our YouTube channel and on our blog. Time now for Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, we're going to L.A.'s Little Tokyo neighborhood, but not for Japanese food.
We're at a new place called The Spice Table, which is, I suppose, hybrid Singaporean, if you wanted to call it that.
Singaporean food is some of my favorite. Describe what it is that we're expecting when we go to eat that kind of food.
Well, everybody expects something different when they hear Singaporean because the classic experience, of course, is the hawker centers, the millions of former street vendors who are gathered together under one roof, each selling one specific dish that ideally they and their family have been specializing in for four or five generations. Singapore as a food capital is odd, though, because it's where four cultures come together. And it's the splash and the sort of carom shots that resolve from that that make the cooking so interesting.
So what are the four cultures that come together?
Well, Chinese, you have Malaysian, you have Indonesian, and you have Southern Indian, which are all heavily represented. And I suppose you would also have to add a fifth one, which is the Western culture that has been in the city for as long as it's been a city.
So we're talking about bright flavors, sour, we're talking about spicy, we're talking about coconut.
Often coconut, often tamarind, often not just fish sauce, but something called belacan, which is fermented shrimp paste, which is toasted, which has a really strong fish plus armpit aroma that a lot of Singaporean food is absolutely unthinkable without. There's obviously a lot of spices because it's in the middle of where all the spices are from. So there's a lot of black pepper. There's a lot of turmeric. There's a lot of garlic and a lot of chilies.
So how does this sort of cultural confabulation play out at the restaurant, The Spice Table?
When you walk into The Spice Table, if you've spent a lot of time in L.A. restaurants, you'll probably end up doing a double take because you've seen these people around before. I mean, the chef, Brian Ng, and his wife, Bonnie Jang, both worked at Moza in its very earliest days. I mean, Brian was the guy who ran the pizza oven. But it's these people who are restaurant pros who have worked at, you know, great not Asian restaurants for years that are doing their dream project, which happens to be Asian.
So let's get into the menu. What did you eat here that you really enjoyed?
Probably you should start off having a couple satays because, A, satays are a key part of Singapore cooking, whatever it is. And it's always great to go to sort of the more Islamic hawker centers there where you see actually really old guys who are, you know, fanning flames with straw fans and grilling skewers of meat. You can get the usual chicken and beef and pork here. The lamb belly is nice. It's sort of really rich and unctuous. But the one you should get if they offer it to you is the tripe, which really is chewy and soft and absorbs the flavor of the smoke as if it was born to do it. It's a gorgeous dish. There are things you would never expect at this restaurant, like a really nice sort of whipped chicken liver pate with a house-made baguette, or I guess what you would call like buffalo wings, except they're not buffalo wings. They're really spicy, and they're flavored with curry. And they're super crunchy, and there's no amount of them that you can have in front of you that they will not be finished within seconds.
So is The Spice Table all about a lot of small plates so you can have lots of bites of different things?
Like most of the interesting restaurants in town now, it is about small plates. I mean, you wouldn't have one plate of chili prawns and hog it all to yourself. You would probably share it bountifully with everybody else on the table. And then in turn, they would share their, you know, dish of fried cauliflower with you or their dish of cabbage braised with bacon and dried shrimp for that extra little punch of treif that makes everything so good.
What about laksa dishes?
Laksa, of course, is that noodle that's in Singapore and Malaysia that's different almost in every town you go to. Their version is good. It's different from anything I've ever had because it does have that big punch of fermented shrimp paste in it that you don't expect. It's always there lurking in the back, but here it almost becomes dominant, and it's really good. It's a sophisticated broth, and the noodles that come with it are quite good. The other two things that I think everybody should get are their version of black pepper crab, which is my single favorite Singaporean dish. You go to the seafood restaurants on the East Coast and eat black pepper crab and watch the endless line of oil tankers pull into the harbor. Theirs is different in that they pull the meat out of the shell and they pile it on toast as sort of a black pepper crab canapé. There's an acidic element to it that there isn't usually, and it's delicious.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the Spice Table on Central Avenue near East First Street in LA's Little Tokyo neighborhood. Get the exact address and recommended dishes sent to your cell phone. Just text the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to 69866. All of Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions are on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on our blog. If Southeast Asian food interests you, I do hope you'll join me at the Broad Stage on May 1st, where we'll be talking about and tasting street food from around the world, from the hawker centers of Singapore and the ubiquitous taco trucks of L.A. Tickets are on sale now at kcrw.com/globalstreetfood. Admission includes tastes from six of L.A.'s best food trucks. Coming up, a look at Mexican food in America with Gustavo Arellano. That's next. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Gustavo Arellano with Good Food, and we're here at Mitla Cafe in San Bernardino. Mitla Cafe is the oldest continually operating Mexican restaurant in the Inland Empire, but also the oldest continuously operating restaurant, period, in the Inland Empire. Here is a throwback to the old days of California Mexican cuisine at its classic. Everything is smothered in meat sauce. Everything has sour cream on it. Everything has cheese on it. It's a type of dish that, ironically enough, even though it's Cal-Mex cuisine, it's disappearing here in Southern California as we start getting more Mexican immigrant cuisine here into the region. So I'm here with Steven Oquendo. He's the general manager of Mitla Cafe. How long have you been working for Mitla Cafe?
I've been here since I was 6, 7 years old. I was able to wash a dish, but I started working here after high school, so probably about 16, 17. I'm 38 now. My great-grandma started it in 1937.
What part of Mexico did your family come from?
They came from Jalisco. Their favorite part of Mexico was Oaxaca, the ruins over there. So that's where the name Mitla came from, was the city of the dead, and which is located in Oaxaca.
Tell us a little bit about the history, then, of Mitla. Like, why did your great-grandma decide to open it?
She decided to open it, I think, just to have something to do. My grandfather worked at the railroads, so it was right over there. Most of the people from the railroads would come and eat here. It started off just the front part of the restaurant, and then we kind of expanded into this part.
Describe also for the listeners, like, the neighborhood that we're in. Like, what's the significance of the neighborhood here in San Bernardino?
This is the Mexican part of San Bernardino. This is the west side,
right?
Yeah. This is where we were all born and raised. You know, my grandma has... I live down the street. It's my grandma's house. The people that, when you were eating earlier, that I said hi to, they grew up on 7th Street right here. That's the west side. It's everybody knows everybody, and everybody loves everybody, knows their family, knows their business. It's just a close-knit community.
Okay, so your name, sir?
Joseph Lopez.
How long have you been eating at Mitla Cafe?
Actually, since I was a young boy, I used to come and get tacos here for a dime out the side door.
Describe the west side of San Bernardino for people who have never been out here.
Well, yeah, I was born and raised here, you know, and I'm still here. But basically, it's the barrio, you know, environment here and everything, you know. Families tend to end up buying homes close to where they were born or where they were raised, you know, and they stay in the area. And they tend to frequent the places that they know and the food that they like.
What's your name, ma'am?
Irene Montaño.
Tell us a little bit about the history of Mitla.
My in-laws started it in 1937. My mother-in-law, actually. You know, my sister-in-law had it, and my husband had it when she passed away, and now he passed away, so I have now, you know, so.
For people who would drive out from Los Angeles out here to San Bernardino, what would be some of the dishes that you would recommend to them?
Well, I would recommend our chilorellos, for one thing, and maybe our tamales.
What about the Irene? Describe the Irene plate.
The Irene, that's carne asada with an enchilada, cheese over the top, cheese sauce, and beans, and a little bit of guacamole, and it's a little bit, probably too much cholesterol, but it kind of goes together and tastes good.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
So if you want to go to Mitla Cafe, it's pretty simple to get to. Go from to the 10 to the 215. You want to exit on 5th Street, and it's off old Route 66, which is now the corner of Mount Vernon and 6th Street. There's a plaque right there that says Route 66 Roadside Attraction. This is classic California Mexican cuisine at Mitla Cafe. For good food, I'm Gustavo Arellano.
Gustavo Arellano is the managing editor of the OC Weekly, where he reviews restaurants and writes the popular Ask a Mexican column. Now, we frequently talk about Mexican food on this show with Gustavo and with many others, but today I want to go a little deeper. It's part of a series of stories we're doing here at KCRW on Mexican-American culture. Nearly half of all Angelenos are Latino, and many are Mexican. Today, La Plaza is opening. That's the new museum dedicated to the history of Mexicans in Southern California. So where does Mitla Cafe fit in? Well, it's emblematic of a very specific type of Mexican food, Calmex. Gustavo's with me now.
Yeah, Mitla Cafe, again, the oldest Mexican restaurant in the Inland Empire, one of the oldest remaining Mexican restaurants in all of Southern California. Eating the menu is like not just a time capsule, but also it's a museum piece. You're eating foods that myself, as a child of Mexican immigrants, I consider to be exotic, but that the rest of the country has long ago assimilated into their eating styles, the tacos and burritos and chile colorado and enchiladas, of course, all very much a part of what I call, or what I and other food historians call Cal-Mex cuisine, California Mexican cuisine.
And which a lot of people in our state and the country consider Mexican food.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about what we considered, what the United States has considered to be Mexican food. It has changed according, you know, many times in the past, I would say in the past 150 years. For the longest time, what we now call chili was known as chile con carne. That's what passed itself off as Mexican food, even though it's specifically originated around San Antonio and Texas, and it's never been served by actual Mexicans in Mexico. The burrito, which we now consider to be very much a standard of California Mexican cuisine, which the rest of the country is now learning about via Chipotle, that's been around here in Southern California for decades, but it's only now really starting to, or really in the past decade, has started to infiltrate the rest of the United States. Of course, loncheras, taco trucks, here in Southern California, we've had them since the 1930s, but in the rest of the United States, they're finally becoming a fad. So it's fascinating to track how Americans' perception of what constitutes, quote-unquote, Mexican food really does change with the times, and how it's really collapsed under all these various distinct traditions.
How does Calmex food differ from Mexican-American hybrid food in other parts of the country?
First of all, you're only going to have Mexican, traditional classical Mexican-American food where in the American Southwest for the most part. So you have Calmex, our twin titans, of course, the taco and the burrito. That's where they were first became popular among American palates in California. Then you move on, of course, Tex-Mex. That's where you have chili. That's where you have everything baked in cheese, nachos, you know, rolled, stacked enchiladas. Then you have New Mexico, which has been there for hundreds of years. There, the state question is, do you want red or green? Do you want red sauce on your food or green sauce on your food. You have pozole and doing food traditions that mix Native American food with the Spanish influence and then the Mexican influence and then the American influence. You have then what's called Sonoran style food, which masqueraded as Calmex food for a long time. And really, I would say California Mexican cuisine is the daughter of Sonoran food. We're talking about enchiladas. We're talking, that's where the burrito first came in. Recently, we've had what we here call street dogs, you know, bacon wrapped hot dogs. It's more specifically known as Sonora dogs because they originated somewhere along the border between Sonora and Tucson. And then one tradition that always gets overlooked is Colorado Mexican food. Colorado Mexican food, they're also famous for their chili, although not the way we know it in Texas. This is more like a gravy chopped up with some Hatch chilies. And their most famous dish, this goes specifically to Denver, something called the Mexican hamburger.
And what is that?
Oh, my God. The Mexican hamburger, it's one of my favorite dishes. It's all it is. It's a regular burrito, bean and cheese burrito with some carne asada. They put in a hamburger patty inside this burrito, like a big fat hamburger patty, and then they smother it. They call it smothered. What we'd call a wet burrito, they call a smothered burrito. And so they cover it in Denver-style chili, which is gooey, orange. It looks more like nacho cheese, but it is actual chili, and it burns. All the Mexican restaurants in Denver, and only Denver and the suburbs, have them. You're not going to find a Mexican hamburger anywhere else in the United States.
As the gringo communities have become more interested in, quote, authenticity, unquote, and as different Latino immigrant communities move around the country, are we starting to see the beginnings of new Mexican-American food traditions?
It's starting to. I think what's needed is for a community to be established for a couple of generations. That's how we have had the rise of these, you know, Calmex, Sonoran cuisine, Tex-Mex, Colorado Mexican food, because you've had these long-standing food traditions. But, I mean, we're seeing it here in California, the Korean taco. The Korean taco can't be more than a decade old. Now it's being spread across the United States by both Koreans and Mexicans and even non-Mexicans or non-Koreans who just like the taste of a Korean taco. In Chicago and the Mississippi Delta, actually, both places that have a long-standing history of migration between both of those places, they have their own tamale traditions. The tamales that you find in the Mississippi Delta and in Chicago, they're not the tamales that we could find here in Southern California. These are like fatter, smaller, made more with cornmeal itself, like a cornmeal than actual masa, with the meat almost stuck in the center like a cylinder, almost as an afterthought. In Chicago, there's this hot dog / tamale known as a mother-in-law. You basically get a wiener and a tamale, and you put it inside a hot dog bun, and then you smother it all in chili. You can only find it in Chicago, and that's something that's, you know, 50 or 60 years old. So Chicago has its own smaller traditions than, say, you know, the rest of the states.
So fascinating. Thank you so much, Gustavo, for giving us a taste of Mexican-American food tradition.
No, my pleasure.
Gustavo Arellano is currently working on a book called Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, due out next year. You can always find past episodes of Good Food on KCRW's apps for the iPhone and the Android, or download the podcast from iTunes. And get your tickets for our live Global Street Food event with food trucks at kcrw.com/globalstreetfood. Good Food is produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia. Thanks to Connie Alvarez, Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Masiha, and Becky Nelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.